disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest right now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 been war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, June 27th, 2019. We have a jam-packed show for you today. First off, we talk with somebody from No More Deaths who speaks on the aftermath of the trial against Dr. Scott Warren, someone with the Fang Collective about their week of action against 287G, which would allow sheriffs to deputize police's ICE agents, and lastly, somebody from Jam City Antifa about the upcoming anti-fascist convergence against the National Solutions Conference in Burns, Tennessee. We then switch to discussion on the dire need for resistance to the horror of ICE concentration camps. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. This weekend we'll see major anti-fascist mobilizations. On Friday in Seattle, there is a call to defend a trans pride march from the Proud Boys. And Saturday, there is a call for a mass mobilization in Portland, Oregon, against the Proud Boys again, and in Burns, Tennessee, against the so-called National Solutions Conference, which will feature David Duke, Richard Spencer, and reps from various KKK groups. There is currently a call-in campaign linked in our show notes to shut down the conference and kick the Nazis and Klan out of Tennessee parks. Also in Portland, Oregon, members of the Industrial Workers of the World working at the fast food restaurant Little Big Burger are set to vote next week on whether their store will officially join the union. Good luck, everyone. Land struggles continue to kick off. In Appalachia, the fight against the Mountain Valley Pipeline continues. Yesterday, a lockdown stopped construction for almost 8 hours, and the yellowfin tree sit now has been in place for a total of 297 days. Meanwhile, in Northern California, the fight to save the ancient Mattole Forest, a battle which has been unfolding for over 20 years, continues to intensify. Yesterday, quote, a forest defender entered an active logging operation in the Rainbow Ridge region of the Mattole headwaters and locked themselves to an excavator to stop logging and road clearing. A tree sit operated by the land defender known as Rook remains ongoing as well. Check out Save the Mattole on Facebook and Blockade Babes on Instagram for ongoing updates. 100 flyers were mailed to neighbors of a member of Identity Europa / American Identity Movement, alerting them of his involvement in white nationalist organizing. Also on Wednesday, for some uplifting news, workers at Wayfair, a Boston-based furniture company, launched a walkout and wildcat strike once they learned that the store had filled an order with private prisons that were interned migrants. Over 100 workers participated in the walkout, over 400 actually signed a letter in protest officially, and joined a rally against ICE in Boston attended by many hundreds of other supporters, while workers at Wayfair and other places across the U.S. also walked out, although in smaller numbers. And now for some upcoming events. On June 23rd through the 29th, there's a call for a week of action against 287G from the Fang Collective. On June 28th, there's a call to defend Seattle Trans Pride celebrations from the Proud Boys. On June 29th, there's a call for a mobilization against the National Solutions Conference in Burns, Tennessee. On June 29th, there's a call for an anti-fascist mobilization against the Proud Boys in Portland, Oregon. On June 29th through the 30th, the Southern Regional Organizing Assembly of the IWW is taking place in Richmond, Virginia. On July 1st, there is a mobilization against the Dekalb County Jail outside of Atlanta, Georgia. From July 3rd to the 10th, come out for the Earth First Rendezvous in Utah. On July 6th, there is a mobilization in D.C. against the alt-right. On July 6th, there is an anti-ICE mobilization in Long Beach, California. On July 8th through the 12th, there is a week of action called against ICE and banks profiting off of ICE. On July 27th through the 28th, there is an anarcho-punk festival happening at the Gilman Street Club in Berkeley, California. On August 3rd through the 11th, there is the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking happening in so-called Worcester, Massachusetts. And on August 16th through the 18th, come out for the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence happening in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. Meanwhile, on August 23rd through the 24th, there is the Bend the Bars Conference in Lansing, Michigan. On August 23rd through the 25th, another Carolina Anarchist Book Fair is happening in Asheville, North Carolina. And finally, on September 28th, get ready for the Toronto Anarchist Book Fair. That's going to do it for us, and we will see you next time. Okay, we're joining here today with Maria from No More Deaths. We're going to be talking about what's been happening since the end of the trial with Dr. Scott Warren. There's an upcoming day of action that No More Deaths is calling for. And just kind of pick your brain about stuff in general. But just to start off, before we get into talk about the trial, can you just tell us a little bit about the support that you all have received? There's been just constant demonstrations out on the streets outside of the where the trial was held, and there's been a lot of solidarity, definitely a lot of stuff being written about No More Deaths. Can you just tell us a little bit about all that?
Sure. We had a really great outpouring from the local community. We had different theme days for folks who wanted to come out and show solidarity with the work that we do and with Scott Warren. We had faith leaders come from a myriad of different religions. We had educators come out one day. We had medical providers. And then just people came out, not on the theme days, from around the community. I think at least in Tucson, Arizona, and also in other parts of the state, humanitarian aid is a collectively held value that has worth despite the state's attempt to criminalize it.
So now that the trial of Dr. Scott Warren is over, this is like the second trial of No More Deaths volunteers in the last few months. Do you think that the state will continue their attempts at repression? Like, do you think that they will come back and recharge Dr. Scott Warren, or they will go after new charges in the foreseeable future?
Well, we're hoping that they won't choose to retry. I think a hung jury is pretty indicative that the government did not make its case and did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this expanded definition of harboring is reasonable in any way in regard to the current laws that they're trying to utilize. And as far as future charges for other volunteers, you know, we really hope not. We have really well established that humanitarian aid is a value that people share in Tucson and also in other parts of the country, and people are behind us with the work that we do. It's a pretty well codified international standard to be able to provide food, water, medical care in crisis situations from an international perspective, and our policies are pretty well reflective of the way that other groups internationally do their work. So we're hoping that the state will choose not to retry Dr. Scott Warren, and that we won't have future legal problems and can move on and focus on what we want to be doing, which is our work in the field.
Well, kind of piggybacking off of that question, you know, now a lot more people know about No More Deaths than they did before, and just everything that it does and the conditions that it operates within. Do you feel that this in some ways backfired on the state's attempt to really demonize the work that you all do?
I think it's been a great opportunity to let people understand really specifically the policies the U.S. government has been implementing in the Southwest over the last 15 years and exactly how detrimental the militarization of the border has been, and reflect the acute loss of life that has happened here. I think any time that we are given a national or international platform from which to talk about the real effects of government policies, and otherwise, you know, these things are happening in otherwise remote areas, it's definitely an opportunity.
Well, you brought up the policies in the last 15 years. Just within the last couple of days, right before Trump in Florida kicked off his 2020 election campaign, he stated that in the next week, ICE will begin the roundups of upwards of like 1 million people. Some people have kind of written this off as bluster, that they don't have the capacity to do that. What are your thoughts on these recent statements that they're going to be doing such a massive operation?
So I think the Trump administration has just continued immigration policy that was put in place by the Obama administration and had his roots in the Clinton and the Bush era. And I think that Trump enjoys hyperbole and speaks very offhand and is extremely racist. As far as whether or not we're going to see a large number of raids, I think it's really important for people to understand that people are already having their cases reopened. Cases that were previously closed under prosecutorial discretion under Obama are being reopened daily. Traffic stops, at least in the Southwest, can routinely lead to detention and deportation, and minor infractions or exchanges with any law enforcement. So whether or not they're going to be doing large raids is definitely a concern. But I think it's important for people to understand that the enforcement mechanism is functioning at an extremely high level currently, and that the Trump administration is kind of externalizing their border enforcement currently to Mexico, and that the conditions for asylum seekers along the border are extremely dangerous, and that, you know, with the expansion of minors in detention and the continued construction of functionally concentration camps for civilians, that, you know, whether or not Trump will follow through with the hyperbolic thing he said this week, I think is less important than reflecting on the actual policies that are already being put in place.
In a couple days, No More Deaths is calling for solidarity actions against prevention through deterrence. Can you talk a little bit about this?
So prevention through deterrence was a joint act of Congress that was passed in 1994. And the basic spirit or gist of it as legislation was to make crossing so physically and psychologically torturous that people did not felt that crossing was futile and would not attempt to enter the U.S. Without the correct paperwork. And what it concretely meant was sealing off the urban centers where people had historically crossed and funneling people into remote areas. It really weaponized the desert and funneled people into the areas that we now do our work, places, you know, in the West Desert. The longest geographical span of the border for crossing is about 80 miles, and folks are crossing in remote areas with no access to clean water across an active bombing range. So that, along with a real rise in militarization and border infrastructure that got funded when the Department of Homeland Security got reorganized after 9/11, and there was a boost in funding, things like towers and drones and extra border patrol presence, and then a whole series of checkpoints within 100 miles of the border that really made the journey for folks who are crossing more dangerous and longer and definitely more deadly. So in that sense, it was a business opportunity and a gift to the cartels, who are able to consolidate human trafficking and further take advantage of a very vulnerable population. So it's definitely, I think it's good to think of it as an intentional policy of the government that is designed to create death and human suffering. And that is why we're calling for it to end.
I think that's a really good point that you bring up, that a lot of these policies so much are, like you brought up, prevention through deterrence being passed in the mid-90s, obviously under Clinton. I mean, so much of the stuff we're talking about is simply a continuation of previous administrations. It's just playing out under a broader spotlight in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that Trump has brought a certain vitriol and hatred, and a lot of his policies in reference to incarceration of minors, if not new, or at least an expansion, but he was really gifted the infrastructure to enact these policies by the Obama administration, who had already contracted private detention with for-profit prison companies. So a lot of the physical buildings and certainly Border Patrol personnel and ICE personnel, you know, none of his extremely racist, hyperbolic, and hateful policies would realistically be enactable if he hadn't. And, you know, there's also a judicial expanse here. Certainly Sessions, when he was in power, and others after him, have continued to try to redefine all aspects of immigration in this country, from temporary protected status for certain populations to making, you know, the ostensibly legal appeal for asylum much longer and more dangerous, and that's what we're seeing now with people waiting weeks and months in Mexico before being able to present for asylum. So yeah, I think it's important to identify the ways that the current era is scary and dangerous, and the Trump administration is certainly targeting undocumented activists who are also looking at, you know, civil and criminal consequences for their political activism, and we also see the case against God as an extension of that. I think they're trying to put fear in the hearts of anyone who is willing to be in solidarity with undocumented communities.
Well, just in closing, in terms of no more deaths, now that the trial itself is over, anything you want to talk about in terms of the future? I know right now you're probably all really busy doing all these interviews.
You know, we've continued our work even through the course of this process, and we're going to continue to do that. We still have volunteers going out to put water in the desert every day. We continue to do search and rescue for folks who are lost, even when Border Patrol won't collaborate with us, even though they have lots of resources to do that. And we continue to run a legal clinic for people who are trying to redress their current status and close their open deportation cases. And we'll continue to do the advocacy work that we do. I think, we've been forced to kind of be more present in the spotlight and kind of uplift some of the reports that we've put out over the last year about the consequences of things like prevention through deterrence and the militarization of the U.S. border. And if people want to check out any of that body of work, they should check out the disappearedreport.org, which houses a lot of the reports that we've put out over the past few years. But I think generally we'll just continue doing the work that we're doing. And by no means are we the only organization doing humanitarian aid in Southern Arizona. We have a large coalition of other folks who also continue to do the work.
Well, great. Thank you so much for talking with us. Anything else you want to say or touch on?
It's just been really heartening through this kind of long and arduous process of trial to have so many people reach out and support the work that we do across the country and the world. And if you have been one of those people who reached out or donated, I just want to say thank you. It's can get a little disheartening to deal with intense government repression, and I think that we all hold in our hearts a lot of love for everyone who's come out to support us.
We live in a fabled world of dreaming boys and wide-eyed girls, where precious few get a fair start. These times can break you, these times can leave you torn apart. We'll be right back.
My name is Lee, and I'm an organizer with the Fan Collective, which is a group that's based in Providence, Rhode Island, but has members outside of Rhode Island, mostly within the Northeast region. And the Fan Collective started off as what was known as FANG, Fighting Against Natural Gas, since basically it was a collaboration between a lot of folks that had been organizing on the ground in different states within the Northeast region, particularly around the fracked gas industry, which around like 5-6 years ago was really starting to gain traction and try to build more development around in cities and rural areas. So folks got together that were interested in doing like climate justice work and created FANG, Fighting Against Natural Gas, to resist the natural gas industry, which we call the fracked gas industry, and put a stop to all these new projects that were cropping up. And as time went on, FANG transitioned to becoming the FANG Collective. So no longer just fighting against natural gas, even though we still do some of that work. Our climate justice work still connects to how the fracked gas industry continues to try to, you know, put new structures and new infrastructure within poor, low-income neighborhoods, primarily of Black and brown people. So climate justice linked with environmental racism. But now we're starting to do more campaigns that particularly affect different communities that we serve. So, and also that affect our own collective members. So that's how we started our Shutdown ICE campaign last year to target counties in Massachusetts and sheriff's offices in Massachusetts that have 287G agreements with ICE.
Cool. And, you know, before we move on to some other stuff, I also want to say I know that you have a member that's about to go into jail for a little bit of time. And also on our last podcast, we actually did a shout out to them and encouraged people to donate. I think they're going in for what, a week?
Yeah, they just went in yesterday, and they're going to be there for 9 nights. They got sentenced to 10 days, but yeah, they just went in yesterday.
Well, yeah, let's talk about this upcoming week of action. And before we kind of get to that, actually, let's talk about 287G. You already brought it up, but I mean, what is important about this policy that needs to be resisted?
So yeah, 287Gs are some, like 287G agreements have been around for a while, and it's something that came about this immigration reform that Bill Clinton signed back when he was president, which basically allowed local law enforcement agencies to collaborate with ICE, because instead of, you know, expanding ICE itself and providing more money to the Department of Homeland Security, they just said, well, let's allow, you know, local police to do this dirty work for us. Instead of building new detention centers, we can just house undocumented people in the prisons that already exist. So that's kind of like the origin of 287G. It's a piece of this immigration reform that Bill Clinton signed into law in 1996. And basically it's just been, you know, expanding and expanding ever since. FANG in particular, since we do, like, we focus on doing a lot of, like, nonviolent direct action, we base our campaigns on nonviolent direct action and training people to do that. We saw that there was a need to resist, the sheriff's offices and the counties that have 287Gs, because FANG itself is part of this alliance called the Alliance to Mobilize Our Resistance that's based in Rhode Island. And that alliance is focused on providing, like, community-based resources and support for people that are being targeted by, you know, institutional violence. So if, you know, a person is dealing with, like, a potential detention or a potential deportation, that alliance gets, like, a call and starts case managing for individuals and community members. And so FANG's work in terms of doing direct action and being involved in this alliance, they saw that we could target the prisons themselves, right, and pressure and resist the 287G agreements that allow our community members to be detained, and try to put an end to these agreements. Because even though Rhode Island didn't have an operating detention center up until like this past January. So what would happen is that when people from Rhode Island would get picked up by ICE, they would almost all of them would get taken to Massachusetts, because that's where the counties had 287G agreements and had detention centers. So that just made it incredibly difficult for family members to go visit, and for us to provide support, and get them legal representation, because now you're dealing with, Rhode Island law, and then you're dealing with Massachusetts lawyers as well. So it just makes everyone's, life incredibly complicated, including obviously like a person who got detained. And that's where the resisting these particular agreements and the prisons themselves started.
So in the call to action you all put out, it says on June 30th, all the agreements across the country will expire. So then do you foresee them, resetting these things back in legal stone, or what would the process look like?
Yeah, so, June 30th, all of these, memorandums of agreement that the sheriffs have signed, and that ICE has signed are gonna expire. And obviously, ICE has a decision to say, we do not want to continue this agreement with you, just beyond the sheriffs themselves. But if ICE wants to continue the agreement with, the particular county that has it, then the sheriff, all they have to do is, sign another paper, and it's renewed for, however many more years. So the most of the ones that started in 2016, right around, when Trump was elected. So it's really, and some sheriffs have already expressed, in particular Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, who is the sheriff of Bristol County, has expressed that they're going to renew no matter what, because they're xenophobic and racist. So I think it's, definitely pressuring them and showing them that there is a resistance to this. And at the end of the day, sheriffs are, elected officials, and trying to hold them accountable to communities that live there. So we're trying to work locally with people that live in the areas and live in the counties that obviously can hold these freaking sheriffs accountable. But it's been difficult because as a group that obviously believes in prison abolition and doesn't believe in, in police, it's difficult trying to figure out what's the best way to make sure that these agreements don't get renewed when it's literally these sheriffs, these mega cops have this power. Right. So it's we don't want definitely to ask a cop, hey, would you work with us so that you can kick out this sheriff and be nicer to immigrants? We're put in a tough position because it's unless the position of a sheriff is disbanded, it becomes very difficult to find an alternative, and get rid of these agreements if the sheriffs don't want to budge.
For sure. Well, you can go to It's Going Down and also the Fan Collective website, and the call to action is up on both June 23rd through the 29th. Anything you want to say on that week specifically?
Yeah, I think it's important that folks are aware that these agreements exist all across the country. I think it's important that people know about them and that they start, pushing to resist them and wherever they are, especially if, people live in a county or in a city where these kind of agreements exist. It's important to show, solidarity with the folks that are getting detained. And new programs are getting cropped, are happening now. And there's a new program called the Warrant Service Officer Program that's basically an extension of 287G. So showing resistance to that, it's it's never ending work with the immigration stuff, because obviously they're trying to continually enforcing all this horrible stuff. But if folks want to get involved or want some support to plan their own thing and, where they're based, they can definitely contact us, contact the Fan Collective, and we're willing to work with them.
For sure. Well, just to get into some kind of overarching stuff, just this past week has been pretty horrific. There's been a Democracy Now! Reported on Monday that three people in the last couple of days have passed away in detention facilities. There's been, I believe, 6 children that have passed away in the past 8 months, if I'm correct. There was just in El Paso, Texas, kind of this facility that's been getting a lot of news coverage. There was recently an inspection by even the Department of Homeland Security, I believe, and they found that the facility that's supposed to house only 125 people, that there was over 900 people there, people like standing up and, you know, being forced to wear the same clothes and stuff and go to the bathroom around, you know, around people packed together. And some of these areas, like, disease is spreading. I'm just curious. I mean, it seems very clear that the Trump administration is trying to make things as worse as possible to try to, you know, scare people away. Or what is your read on the situation?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's exactly what you said. I think they're, you know, they've come up with this very, like, just truly malevolent strategy of trying to, you know, basically enforce this form of self-deportation. Which, you know, like, freaking Mitt Romney was talking about self-deportation, right? Like, back when, like, Obama was running. And it's pretty much like self-deportation heightened to the max. You know, they're continually enforcing the border, trying to build a wall. Obviously, that's his big thing. But apart from that, like, adding more people, like, more officers on the ground near the U.S.-Mexico border, providing more and more technology that's not necessarily, like, a physical wall, but does a lot to, you know, grab people when they're trying to cross. That makes it incredibly more difficult to cross into the border, and incredibly more dangerous, because as they keep, you know, blocking different paths that people take to cross into the United States, people start finding alternative routes, and those alternative routes become much more dangerous, and much, you know, and that's why, you know, groups like No More Deaths are out there trying to put water and food on the ground so that people don't die. But that's like part one of the strategy of enforcing the border and making it incredibly difficult and deadly to cross. And also, just like, if you do manage to make it, but you get caught, right? Like you mentioned, the conditions in the detention centers have become atrocious. It's become incredibly more difficult to apply for asylum and even get an initial interview, which, like, under human rights law, which is whatever, but it's like they're supposed to be giving them, like, an initial interview so that at least they can say, I'm applying for asylum and you need to treat me like an asylum seeker. And so people are just starting to, you know, sign voluntary departure papers with the idea that, oh, I signed this voluntary departure, I go back and I'll just try to cross again. But it's just becoming more deadly and more difficult. So there, the strategies to enforce the border make it difficult to gain asylum or difficult to just even, you know, step foot onto U.S. soil, as they say. And then, for folks that, you know, get deported back, or are thinking of, you know, making the trip to the United States, it's been announced that U.S. troops are going to be training side by side with Central American police and Central American officers, in particular from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. So they're starting to train them to become basically, you know, ICE down there. So it's going to just be like open season along all of these Central American borders. And Mexico has already started militarizing its border heavily with Guatemala. So it's just this, it's a really, truly evil strategy. And that's why it's so important that we resist, you know, these agreements. And we do the best that we can to ensure that those folks that did make it out here and are currently detained get at, like, the, you know, some kind of decent treatment while they're here. And hopefully get, you know, people released, because, you know, they're fleeing from something, and obviously, like, they come to something much worse. They're facing with something much worse if they get detained. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people just shouldn't be packed together. I mean, it just shows, I mean, how silly, like, all this rhetoric about, you know, disease, or they're bringing disease. It's like, well, what do you think happens when you pack, you know, 900 people into a facility that's only 100, and you don't allow them to change their clothes for a whole week? I mean, you don't think that's leading to a situation where people might be more susceptible to disease, which is what's happening to some of these people that come in, they get sick, and then they unfortunately die.
Yeah. And it's like, obviously every single person, you know, matters in terms of like, whether it's an adult or a young person, but in particular having the babies die, you know, and the young people, it's just truly, it's really fucked up.
Yeah. Another grim statistic I was seeing on Democracy Now was saying that, I mean, not to, you know, exalt like the Obama administration as some, you know, magical administration that was wonderful to immigrants. But I mean, it's quite an upswing in people dying in Border Patrol custody. This hasn't happened like for I think 10 years or something like that, that people have actually died like this. You know, one thing I wanted to ask, and we've been asking a lot of organizers that are organizing around you know, immigration and the border, but last year obviously we saw this huge upswing with Abolish ICE, and that was largely kind of riding the coattails of kind of this viral explosion of images of children being separated from their parents, where it's now, I think we're in a time where it seems like there's a lot more work that obviously has to be put into mobilizing and organizing people to get out to actions and stuff like that. So I'm just curious your thoughts on kind of the mix of both the reality that things are just so bad and there should be a lot of people in the streets, and also just the reality that, you know, we really have to work at getting people out. We don't have the benefit of kind of this viral moment right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a good question, very interesting, because, yeah, definitely, like, those images of, like, the child, you know, like, that classic time child of time cover with the child crying and stuff, really seem to, like, light a fire with people. But now that, like, these children aren't just being separated, they're dying, I don't, you know, it seems like there's not, like, it's becoming normalized, right, that, you know, this is happening. And on, I mean, it's like, it becomes worrisome when, like, obviously people die every day. And like you mentioned, the Obama administration, we just don't know how many people died during the Obama administration, or like how many things weren't reported. But now that, you know, ICE and then these, in particular, like all these zero tolerance policy programs that Trump is putting out, it's causing more and more media attention. And that's why we know about it. But it's very worrisome when, like, kids are dying and it doesn't seem to, like, cause the same reaction. It's like, yeah, it definitely, and people seem to be more and more willing to, you know, donate now, funny enough, instead of organizing to stop things. But it's important that, like, you know, obviously not everyone's able to get out on the streets and do the work in that way. And donating is definitely very important. And if you can, and pitching in however you can. But I think there's so many different ways that, you know, one can plug into, like, the work of supporting undocumented people and immigrant folks in general, that I think it's about finding, like, the best way to support that. Because honestly, like, even if people that are not interested in participating in, like, nonviolence or act action, or can't risk arrest for any particular reason, like, if you're a lawyer, you can provide legal services. You know, if you speak more than one language, like, if there's immigrants of all kinds, you know, being detained, not just necessarily people from Latin America that only speak Spanish. So it's about figuring out how you can plug in. And, you know, there's groups, in particular grassroots groups, that are all over the country doing this work and are trying to figure out how to gain more capacity as more and more people are coming in. So yeah, I mean, it's just finding out like how you can support and how you can plug in. And in particular, I would say if you're going to donate to anyone, don't donate to large groups, like large nonprofit organizations. Like, it's the grassroots groups that are making the connections with people on the ground, with the people inside, and that need that support. So That would just be my little spiel on that.
Yeah. Well, the good news seems to be that definitely there's been some successes. I mean, people have been able to close down some of these places. ICE seems very sensitive, I guess would be one word, to people shining a light on whatever they're doing. They definitely don't want people coming into their facilities and, like, exposing them. They seem to kind of be very shameful of kind of what's going on, and, you know, when that does happen, I think sometimes they you know, they react to it. So at least there's that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's interesting when it's like a prison that's functioning as a detention center, particularly because like prisons already have like such, you know, tight surveillance laws around how you can like talk with people and how you can gain access to like visitation rights and stuff like that. And when you're having like a local prison or a sheriff's prison functioning as a detention center, it's interesting to see how different detention centers serve as like, have like different, you know, regulations around everything. But it just becomes much more, taxing on the community where like this detention center slash prison is held. Because you're no longer sure. I mean, police and sheriff's offices often say, we believe in sanctuary city policies because that way our undocumented community members have like, you know, feel safe calling the police. But it's like, honestly, no one feels safe calling the police anymore. No one's ever felt safe calling the police anymore. And that's just like a foolish argument. But, you know, it's also interesting how there can be like, you can make the link between abolishing ICE and abolishing police, when they're serving as one and the same. And it also brings up a lot of opportunities for solidarity, which is something that we try to talk about a lot when we are holding like, you know, immigration related things, because, we believe that family separation, which was, you know, this thing that started up when kids were getting separated by their families at the border, like family separation is incarceration, not just, you know, detention and deportation. So trying to link like, you know, that prison abolition work around to like ICE abolition and stuff like that. So that's all, it brings a lot of opportunities for solidarity, which is cool.
Well, anything else you want to say or talk about in terms of the week of action or just in general?
Well, I definitely would encourage folks to go to shutdownicenow.org, which is the website that Fang has put together to kind of give a little bit more insight to the campaign that we're running in Rhode Island and in Massachusetts. It also has some resources, and we're going to be updating it with more and more resources, in particular around how, like, if you wanted to start, like, a campaign wherever you are, to resist 287G agreements or what are called intergovernmental service agreements, IGSAs, which allow prisons to serve as detention centers. There's a lot of information and research that we did to put that together. So if folks want to go to shutdownicenow.org or are interested in, you know, doing something around the week of action or at any point in June, really, they can definitely like hit us up and we'd be glad to talk with them around that.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the program. I mean, Fang has been around for a long time and doing some really inspiring work, and it's great to talk to somebody from the group.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, this is LX from the Fascist Free Tennessee Coalition. I'm currently speaking on behalf of the other organizations that will be present. But yeah, there's a lot going down in Tennessee, and this is the second year that this conference has happened. And yeah, it's just been pretty like a shit show down here. Because starting off from Ameren, it's just, you know, kind of ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, why do they like Tennessee so much? Why did they choose that particular facility?
Well, you see, the history of Ameren is that they've been kicked out of pretty much every place that they tried to hold this conference. And Jared Taylor is like friends with the owner park or something. And yeah, they've had the American Renaissance Conference for like damn near 8 years now. And now they're organizing another conference, which is hosted by the Council of Conservative Citizens, on which Jared Taylor is a member. So last year was the first time that the Nationalist Solutions Conference happened, and now it's the second year. And we're hoping to get a mass mobilization out there to send a strong message that this isn't welcome, because, you know, starts with one conference, then it goes to another conference, and then it goes, you know, three conferences and four conferences, and it's just repeated organizing. Like, Unite the Right was organized at these fucking rallies, and you know, the state of Tennessee can't really do much about it because they can't discriminate based off, you know, the group's ideas or whatever. So Jared Taylor is like holding the state of Tennessee hostage to hold these conferences. He's even sued the Parks Committee to hold it, and like he won. So people in Tennessee are just like powerless to do anything about it. So that's why we try to get these people out on the streets to send a pretty like bold message.
Right, and there was over 100 people that turned out for the protest of the American Renaissance Conference, which has been going for a long time, but I think that that's probably one of the better showings of opposition to them, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that was the most people that we've had in a very long time, and, you know, it was a big mobilization, like, word got spread, and, you know, it circulated, and we got it trending, which was a beautiful thing, but like, leading up to the American Renaissance Conference, there have never been that many park police. There haven't been barricades, like, police dogs. Like, none of that was there, like, 2-3 years ago. Like, there's footage of it from years ago. But now, it's like, ever since Unite the Right happened in an incident, like, the state of Tennessee is just shelling out the red carpet for these people. Like, one year, there were snipers on the roofs, and, you know, a group of activists went behind the lake, behind the park or whatever, where everybody else and just the regular civilians were, and there were like armed officers down there. So like the entire park is on like lockdown. Like people can't even go in and enjoy the restaurant or, you know, like enjoy the accommodations that come with a public park. Like a public park is being on lockdown for like a group of Nazis, and it's like ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's very clear too that, you know, who the police are directing their attention at. It's not a keeping the side separate so much as it is, you know, controlling and containing and pushing back against the anti-fascists and basically protecting the white nationalist event.
And, you know, the last mobilization we had at the American Renaissance Conference this year in 2019, like, that was the first time that people had openly consented and agreed not to go in that, you know, so-called free speech pin, because, you know, if you have to enter a pin just to voice an opinion, that's not freedom or, like, you know, free speech. But yeah, the mobilization was very, very well executed, like optics and getting the groups out there. We shut down two of the streets and prevented some of the members from going and picking up other folks. Like, I mean, all these Identity Europa members were in their cars driving into this conference, but we had a good mobilization because once they got in, they weren't allowed to come back out because they had to go pick up other members. So we cut some of the attendance, but not necessarily a big shutdown. But I think for the first time that's happened, that was a pretty, pretty big deal.
And tell us a little bit about the National Solutions Conference. This has kind of some older folks. You mentioned the Council for Conservative Citizens. They're tied to Jared Taylor. They're kind of famous because they helped inspire Dylann Roof. Richard Spencer is famously going to speak at this event, as is David Duke. And we were hearing that kind of the Klan group that Duke formed, that kind of matured after a couple of years, they're part of this as well, I believe, too, right?
Yeah. The Nationalist Solutions Conference is, you know, being organized, again, by Jared Taylor. He's on the board of Conservative Citizens. And basically, it's like a yearly meeting to, like, sell things, collect dues, and, you know, bring new people in. Like, Billy Roper and the Shield Wall Network, like, attended these events, and they've been trying to spread their message, like, through the local media stations and all these different outlets, and it's just like, it's just terrifying to know that these people are in like Nashville's backyard and the state is doing nothing about it.
Yeah, Billy Roper on the Shieldwall Network, pretty frightening people. They've kind of come out to a lot of the stuff that's been happening in Arkansas, at the Capitol. They've been showing up along with the highwaymen, but they're, you know, they've picked up some of the people that have kind of left the Traditionalist Worker Party, but they're full-on neo-Nazi flying the swastika types.
And that's what was witnessed at the American Renaissance Conference, because there was a stream where Daryl Lamont Jenkins of the One People's Project, he's done good work, he was giving a speech, and like a member of the Nationalist Socialist Movement drove by in like this silver truck and yelled like "Sieg Heil" out the window, like a Nazi salute and everything, and everybody just turned like, whoa, what in the world is going on here? So, you know, after that happened, everybody was just like, all right, we need to go up to this conference center and we need to make a freaking statement, because this is getting like out of hand. And to be met with that kind of police presence, like what these people are protecting, like some people don't even know like what they're protecting. Like they're just out there following orders. And it's just like, it's insane, you know?
Do you all feel that just kind of the name recognition that Spencer and David Duke has, is that going to bring more people out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When you mention Charlottesville, the first name that should come up is freaking Richard Spencer, you know? Like, it's, despite what manifested in Charlottesville, it's like this group organized that here in Tennessee, and they were allowed to organize it. Like, people know about David Duke from, you know, back in the day, the 1970s, as the Grand Wizard of the Klan. And to think that he's still active and doing the same stuff after all these years, like, that should definitely garner some numbers. And, you know, with the new alternative right and all that nonsense, it's just a bad scene, you know? Like, that should, Richard Spencer is no new name in, you know, the fascist scene.
Well, can you all talk about just kind of, like, how the coalition has kind of come together? What are some of the different people that are involved, and how have you kind of like reached out to other folks?
Yeah, so the coalition that was formed was with a broad range of groups around Nashville, Tennessee, like the Poor People's Campaign, local anti-fascist groups, anti-racist networks. Really, it's like a coalition of old school folks that were trying to shut it down like in the 1990s. And, you know, us new generation folks, like, you know, the new anti-fascist groups that have popped up in Nashville that are doing good work. Yeah, it's just like, it's not really a new thing in Tennessee, but we don't want it to become an annual thing. You know, it's good that we can bring our community together and we have that community support and solidarity. But at the same time, it's like, this threat can't keep going on, you know, in a sort of sense. It is good to see the local anti-fascist groups work together and branch out in Tennessee, because it does grow our movement. But, like, if we can shut this conference down, that would be even bigger, because, you know, it's gone from just the American Renaissance Conference to the Nationalist Solutions Conference, and then they're going to try to hold another conference and another conference. So we don't want them to be able to gain steam in Tennessee, you know? And the area of Dixon, Tennessee, where it's being held, has had heavy Klan activity. Like, there's Confederate monuments on the courtyard, so the community of Dixon to the Confederacy, so, you know, they're not going to really take a hard stance against, you know, white nationalist talking points, because they think it's, oh, it's just ideas. Ideas don't manifest into violence. Like, no, we know ideas manifest into violence. That's why we're out there defending against it, you know?
Right. You know, I think you bring up a really interesting point about Jared Taylor, how he's kind of connecting these two conferences. And I think that really shows how there's really, because, I mean, Taylor is somebody that's tried to kind of distance himself from, like, you know, skinheads and swastika banners and stuff like that. But, I mean, this really shows that really that delineation is really kind of visceral. Like, they're all very much connected to each other, and they're all in the same room.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is, like, Jared Taylor has been banned from Europe because he tried to go overseas. And, you know, like, Jared Taylor is trying to grow an international network of extremists. Like, he tried to attend some far-right conference in Sweden and got banned for a year. And he's flown in members of Generation Identity, which is kind of like the European version of Identity Europa. And, you know, those people have been active in our community, and they're all being welcomed by Jared Taylor. So it's like, it's like creating a snowball effect that's going to have an effect around the world. Like, it's not just, oh, we don't agree with them, they're in our park. Like, no, this is like international terrorism going on right here. Like, this is kind of serious.
Right. Well, what would you say to people that are listening to this that can, you know, drive out to this event and they want to get involved, or even if they can't make it, is there a way that they can support what's going on?
Yeah, you can follow Jam City Antifa on Twitter, Facebook, WordPress. They're a good group around Nashville. And Nashville Antifa is pretty solid. The Poor People's Campaign and Tennessee Anti-Racist Network, those are all pretty legitimate organizations. Locally, if you're coming from out of state, just, you know, listen to the voices in the community and just, you know, follow us and support everything we do, because this is going to be an ongoing thing. You know, like, we're not just going to go out and protest and then leave. Like, no, we're going to send a strong message, and we're asking anti-fascist, anti-racist coalitions from wherever, like, get to Tennessee, help us out down here, you know?
Right. Well, it was definitely inspiring seeing, you know, that many people out there. I mean, because it is like, you know, it's a park, and it's I mean, it's quite a drive away from a big city, right? How far away is it from Nashville?
It's about, you know, 20-30 minutes. But, you know, Nashville's full of, you know, countryside, hillside, so it's no big deal. Like, we got things set up for folks, so, you know, we're pretty welcoming down here, pretty chill, just, you know, hit us up, come out and support the action, and just, you know, get in touch, you know, show that solidarity.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on. And again, we encourage people to go to the mobilization if you can. Check out Jam City Antifa online, and there is lots of links. You'll see it in this show, and it's on the upcoming events section for more information on how to support the mobilization and come out and get involved. Okay, and we're back, and the glory of political debates begins in front of us. I didn't watch it.
I caught parts of it. I ended up, so there's two debates, just for people that haven't been keeping up with the madness of all of this. To get onto the debate stage for the Democratic primaries, I think you had to have like 35,000 individual donors or something, or 3,500. I forget the exact number. And that could be any donor of any level, including a dollar.
Measure of your worth in a democracy.
Yeah, right.
Vote
right.
With your dollars.
So essentially 20 of the, I think there's now 26 people running for president in the Democratic primary. Like, another person announced this week, Joe Sestak from Pennsylvania, who, like, if you've never lived in Pennsylvania, you have no idea who this guy is. he's like a failed former senator, from PA.
Sure, he's going to do great.
He jumped in this week. But so, 20 of the 24 to 26 or 27 people running made the cut. And the way that they decided to do this was they decided to have two debate nights in a row. So last night was first debate night. Tonight is the second night. And the way that that worked is essentially they threw all the names in a hat and just pick 10 names to go on the first night. And so last night was a bunch of not very prominent candidates, people like Tim Ryan and Bill de Blasio from New York and Julian Castro, people who are polling really low. And then you had Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, who's not doing particularly well, and then Elizabeth Warren were up last night. And so essentially the takeaway from this is that Julian Castro eviscerated Beto O'Rourke because O'Rourke doesn't know anything about anything. Cory Booker got mad because Beto O'Rourke tried to speak Spanish, and Elizabeth Warren decided to endorse single-payer healthcare and gave this big speech about how insurance companies are evil. And that's kind of the thing everyone's been taken away, is that Elizabeth Warren decided definitively to state that her healthcare position is the same as Bernie Sanders. And what's really interesting about that is that the race is starting to shape up in such a way that what you're really looking at is you're looking at a competition largely between Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. All the other candidates have kind of flattened out in their poll numbers and are sort of holding really steady, but they're not increasing support at all. And the only candidate that's really losing a lot of support is Bernie Sanders.
You know, it's interesting. I listen to NPR and, like, you know, really centrist outlets.
Yeah.
And again, a couple things always stand out for me. For one, it's completely true that, like, there is no real discussion on the issues, really. Like, it's all like a, it's like an e-channel reporting from the red carpet. It's like, oh, did you see this, or they wore that, or they said this, or he sniffled. It's like, it's such like a visceral, like such a pedestrian kind of, you know, we all know that this is crap type discussion. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's really bizarre when you think about it. And, I mean, that's really like what it's about. It's just, it's a discussion on, you know, if someone is electable, not even just like their policies or their ideas or anything like that. And that's just really the discussion. I think we've talked about this before, but just really this kind of like inside baseball, like, will this person get elected? You know, are they electable or not? And I think that's why, again, like, there's this like push towards, you know, Biden, which I think is, you know, in itself political too, because obviously, like, centrist, like, corporate media aligns very well with, like, centrist corporate Democrats, of course.
Right.
But I'm curious your thoughts, like, was there anything in the debates that kind of aligns with this idea that this election will be a referendum on socialism?
Which, yeah, I mean, so Elizabeth Warren is a really interesting candidate in this way, in that if you didn't listen to any of the things she ever said about democratic socialism, you just assume that she was a democratic socialist in most ways, right? Like, she'll talk about markets, but democratic socialism involves markets, right? Like, we need to get over this idea that democratic socialism is anti-capitalist, right? It's market socialism in the kind of European model. And there are people in the DSA that skew way further left than that. But at the end of the day, the kind of, for lack of a better term, political class within those circles is very much of a kind of like Euro socialism, market socialism, kind of Swedish model sort of politics, right?
You know, what's interesting is I saw somebody on, I don't know, it was CNN or MSNBC, and they said, if the Democratic Party continues to go, this was like some rich donor person, but they said, if the Democratic Party continues to go, you know, quote, to the left so much, people like me are going to stop giving them money.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, there was a big article in the New Yorker about Elizabeth Warren this maybe last week or the week before. And part of the article, they talked about Wall Street bankers and their response to her. Because for people that don't know, I mean, she has a very long history of trying to very heavily regulate specifically investment banks, right?
Right.
But also like consumer banks that give mortgages, people that do credit cards, right? Just anything that involves sort of either big investments or like consumer finance, right? And her background isn't actually studying academically the reasons that people end up in poverty, even when they're working, right? And the way that that's become a lot more common. And so like that's very central to her entire narrative. And what a lot of these bankers are saying is like, look, I mean, like, I'm a Democrat and everything, and I really hate Donald Trump, but Elizabeth Warren scares the crap out of me. And I probably will stop participating if she becomes a nominee, right? And that was a pretty clear mantra. And we all know why that is, right? I mean, people with money in the United States really feel like they can essentially buy political complicity by threatening to walk away, right? And just like with debates around sports stadiums, right? And John Oliver did a really good special, this was a couple years ago, about sports stadiums and the same dynamic where the wealthy go, hey, like, we own your baseball team and we want a new stadium and we want you to pay for it and we want to lease it for $1 a year. Oh, and we also want the naming rights, so we can sell the naming rights to someone for tens of millions of dollars. And if you don't give us that, we're just going to take the team somewhere else. Right? And people will cave. Right? People love their sports teams and they will cave. And that is a very typical relationship that a lot of Americans have with the rich. And it's one that at some point we just need to sit there and say, yeah, we don't care anymore. Because that's the only way that that relationship, which does border on extortion, will ever end, right? I mean, these are people who make their money off extortion. They're capitalists, right? And they continue to leverage that extortion in their sort of compiled wealth politically all the time. And at some point, the Democratic Party, and this has been coming for a long time, the Democratic Party in its contemporary form is probably going to have to make a choice between, you know, shifting all of their priorities towards the donor class, which is represented by Biden in this case, or shifting their priorities to the Democratic base, which is being more and more represented by people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, right? On the debate stage last night, there was definitely that, that tension, right? And what was really fascinating is that it seems like Elizabeth Warren's strategy now is to find the most wonky policy-centric, research-centric way to take as many positions as she can justify that are as close to Bernie Sanders as possible, as a way to kind of steal his voter base away from him, because she can present as more moderate, but only barely, but enough that it makes some people more comfortable, right? And that seems to be where she's going. That's a pretty interesting turn. And we'll see what happens after tonight.
Because, I mean, some people would say that there needs to be some sort of, like, left populist person in order to win. There was actually an interesting article in The Guardian that came out recently where it argued that, look, Trump's base is electrified. He's given them what they want. I mean, he's got evangelicals in his pocket because of the Supreme Court. You know, he may not have built the wall, but he's doing enough to make people that are really animated by, you know, this boogeyman of immigration to be happy. I mean, all the people that voted for him in 2016 have all the reason to solidify everything that he's done by voting for him again. You know, he may have lost like the Rust Belt truck drivers and stuff that we've talked about, but maybe that doesn't matter, that he'll still have enough people to vote for him while there's like, you know, 20 Democratic people, you know, running around trying to run for president. And again, like, this matters to us as anarchists because this is going to change the playing field in terms of who's president. Although a lot of these big structural things, of course, that we're talking about are, I mean, they're going to happen regardless. So in some ways, you know, we're talking about deck chairs on the Titanic here.
Yeah. Well, and the Democrats have a problem now, right? Because Trump started his campaign officially. He's running against candidate X, right? Whoever that happens to be. And they're still running against each other. And so there's this kind of tacitly acknowledged, dynamic in which you're not supposed to criticize major candidates, right? So what you saw a lot of last night was kind of minor candidates trading barbs with each other, but the major candidates kind of floated through without really much damage. The problem with that is, and I think the Democrats will come to realize this soon, is that no one's excited about Joe Biden. But if other Democrats don't start attacking Joe Biden's record, specifically around questions of race and specifically around questions of sexual harassment and things like that, Biden will be the nominee, right? That's almost given. And from what we learned in 2016, people don't like candidates with the air of inevitability, obviously, right? And so they're stuck in this place right now. And I think that this is a really fascinating moment in American political history for this reason. And that they're stuck in this place right now where their party is splitting apart between a much younger, much more energized, much more lefty base and a much older, much more inevitable, much more entrenched hierarchy, right? And that hierarchy really wants Joe Biden to be the nominee. That is abundantly clear. But the base doesn't, largely. And he's never really polled above 35%, except on the first day. And what that means is that if he were to be the nominee, there is a very good chance, or at least a solid chance, Trump wins re-election. But if he's not, then there's a very good chance that the Democrats are going to have to find different sources of money.
It's interesting that
finds a lot of political dynamics around wealth in the United States.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, one thing is interesting, though, in that to go back to the Guardian article, they argued that, you know, the electoral playing field now is made up of impassioned minority voting yes. blocks.
Yes.
And not like, you know, a supermajority that, of course, in this country is one that's, I would say, is disaffected by the entire political system, but mm-hmm. according to polls is, you know, hates Trump.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. But, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day at a forum on immigration, and I was asking them what they thought of, you know, the current electoral field. And they said, you know, prepare yourself for four more years of Trump. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Something to think about, especially mm-hmm. with the rest of the stuff that we're going to be talking about today in terms yes. of detention facilities and everything else. But, you know, if we're ready to move on, the other big yeah. thing is, you know, NRA TV has left us, unfortunately.
Yeah, so I don't know how many people have ever watched NRA TV.
It is insane.
It's insane. It's like if you could imagine the fever dreams of people in the alt-right manifest as a television show, and then couple that with like reality TV shows where people blow stuff up, that's essentially NRA TV.
It looks like some media riot porn, and then there's like some lady or angry man that comes on with like socialist tears t-shirts and then just says, yeah. Antifa's gonna kill your kids.
Yeah, and so NRA TV is a very interesting kind of dynamic in which like it ostensibly was crafted by a marketing company called Ackerman McQueen, which had worked with the NRA for decades, right? I mean, so for people that don't know, the National Rifle Association didn't used to be this way, right? The National Rifle Association used to be a gun club, essentially, and they did like gun safety trainings and they advocated for shooting ranges at state parks, and it was pretty apolitical for a very long time. And then Charlton Heston took it over. And in the sort of paranoia of Charlton Heston's worldview, the NRA became this like virulently right-wing organization. And for a long time, it sort of just stayed that way and built up its lobbying arm and its donor base and its member base and really became very powerful in lobbying against gun laws, right? But as part of that process, one of the things that they decided around the 2016 election was that they needed to be able to shape discourse permanently to entrench their politics as a given within the United States. And so Ackerman McQueen created and ran NRA TV. And so NRA TV, their spokesperson was a lady named Dana Loesch. If you don't know who she is, look her up online because she's quite something. She's like, if you've ever seen a video of like someone who kind of looks like a soccer mom, but then she gets a scowl and starts yelling about like how the world is falling apart and how we need guns to protect ourselves from the Antifa. That's Dana Loesch, right? And so what NRA TV did was it didn't just have shows like normal reality TV shows. It had some of those too. And it even had fashion shows, of course, shows about like fashionable, like gun carrying accessories and stuff for people with concealed carry permits. And it had reality TV shows like ex-Navy SEALs and stuff, right? That's pretty given. But it's quote news content did this thing where it started to take on far-right talking points, like the anti-fascists are working with the Islamists to overthrow the U.S. government, for example, or terrorists are part of the migrant caravan, or, you know, any number of other, like the U.N.'s going to come take away your guns, right? Like real fringy far-right conspiracy theory stuff. And it packaged it in this really slick way. And so then outlets like Fox News or Sinclair Broadcasting would take segments from NRA TV and broadcast them on cable news. And what that eventually did and what that has entrenched to a large degree is a level of paranoia and right-wing reactionary politics in the gun community, which is not insignificant in the United States. And it's very much normalized extreme right-wing arguments, right? And that's had this very damaging impact on not just the gun community, right? So people that are part of the gun owners community in the United States that are not super right wing. I have friends that do this. They definitely, when they go to the range, like wear flannel shirts and try and look as normal as possible, to avoid a confrontation with somebody. Because the entirety of gun culture, or most of it, has become super right wing. And that's very dangerous in a lot of ways, right? Not everybody in the gun owning community in the United States, knows how to or cares to, not shoot random people with those, right? They now have justification to try and do so. And it creates a really dangerous situation in the US where simultaneously the NRA is saying, cool, you should have guns everywhere, which is like, fine, like totally cool with that. But it's about the mentality of the people that are carrying them, right? So conceal carry, the discourse around that, for example, NRA TV is a large part of this. The discourse around that has gone from, I'm going to carry a gun on me just in case something bad happens, to I need to carry a gun on me in case there's an active shooter situation because I need to be the good guy with the gun, right? And if that means like taking out a couple people as collateral damage in the process of being a hero, cool. And it's really fostered this kind of apocalyptic, polarizing discourse around firearms ownership. And that's very dangerous, right? So NRA TV going away is probably a good thing. The reason that happened is that Ackerman McQueen and the NRA are locked into a conflict around ostensibly financial spending. But Wayne LaPierre, the president of the NRA, accuses Ackerman McQueen and their chief, the chief lobbyist for the NRA who quit this week, of trying to orchestrate a coup against him with Charlton Heston and a couple other people like Oliver North and people like that that are on the board of the NRA. And so it's become a power struggle internal to an organization that's also on the verge of bankruptcy. And so it's entirely possible that the NRA maybe won't cease to exist, but very likely will be very diminished in their ability to have political power in the near future. Yes. Because of collapsing internally and NRA TV falling apart, is very much a symptom of that, for sure.
There's an article, and it's going down, like a personal essay about someone's, we tweeted this out again recently, but someone's kind of personal growth from like gun culture to anarchist. You know, it talks about the history of the NRA. I think it's interesting, you need to bring up the Charlton Heston thing of this, you know, rightward shift. I think, you know, if we go back, there's always been, you know, a white supremacist kind of vein through a lot of gun culture that's, you know, defending against, you know, the, you know, in the face of the frontier or natives or, you know, slave revolts or whatever like that. This idea that you're going to be this auxiliary force to protect the plantation or the state. So and I think obviously the NRA embodies a lot of that. What's interesting though is that, you know, like after Waco and things like Ruby Ridge, I mean, the NRA, like, actually Wayne, Dupree,
yeah,
the guy that like now goes to CBAC and like screams about, you know, Black Bloc being paid protesters and they're coming to take your guns and all this stuff. I mean, he was calling FBI agents, jackbooted thugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, George Bush Sr. actually left the NRA in protest over those mm-hmm. sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have, you know, the LA rebellion pops up in 2000 or 1992, which actually is a year before Waco. And they were saying things like, you know, this wouldn't have happened if people would have been armed and they were ready to put this down. You know, so, I mean, it's very clear, you know, the racial politics of those dynamics where it's like, and it's interesting because the article I mentioned on It's Going Down talks about this, but there's this one point during the Waco siege that really is never really talked about, but the people inside, I mean, it was a horrible massacre. I think over 60 people died.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally burned children alive in this thing.
Yeah.
But at one point, the people inside of it, there was kind of a tower on the Waco building and they dropped this banner and they said, Rodney King, we understand.
Yep.
And I think that it's this really interesting moment where it's like they made a connection between the rebellion that had happened in Los Angeles and police repression and like what they were going through, which, you know, was horrible. I mean,
yes,
you know, it was disgusting what happened to these people.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that changed with the war on terrorism, right? Mm-hmm. So the NRA for a long time and the militia movement, their narrative of the Second Amendment was very much that the Second Amendment exists for us to protect ourselves against state violence, right? And that is the original intent of that, right? It's something that I've tried to explain to friends of mine that didn't grow up in the United States about how weird that is, about how that's very entrenched in a national narrative of armed struggle, how that frames a lot of the way that politics happened in the U.S., and like why a lot of people feel a lot of attachment to that, even though the reality of that is sort of absurd, right? Like fighting a frontal war with the state is kind of an absurd strategic reality. But people feel very attached to that idea. After September 11th, though, the NRA really shifted its narrative to you own guns to protect yourselves against terrorists. And you need to form a militia to be an auxiliary force of the state to protect against, quote, immigrants and terrorism and so on, so on, so on, right? And that's expanded. Now it's you need to be an auxiliary force of the state to protect yourself against, quote, street gangs or school shooters or whatever, right? And what that's done is it's essentially turned a lot of elements of the NRA and most of the militia movement into sort of proto-state paramilitaries. And we've seen that in the recent past, in the last 2-3 years, when fascists show up and 3%ers show up and Oath Keepers show up, and the Oath Keepers are protecting fascists and the 3%ers are marching with the fascists. These are both organizations that in their declared principles are sort of at least vaguely like small government-y kind of libertarian, like right-wing libertarian organizations, and not at least in their declared principles, super sympathetic to fascism. But practically they've become that way. And a lot of that has to do with these shifts in the militia movement, which has been at least to a large degree sparked by differences and changes in the narrative of the NRA. Yeah. It's normalized a lot of that, and it's expanded its reach.
What's fascinating, you know, we had on the It's Going Down podcast, gentleman Leonard Zeskin, who wrote Blood and Politics, which is a history of the white nationalist movement. And after Ruby Ridge, Aryan Nations and Christian Identity, which is kind of like a neo-Nazi reading of the Bible, camps, which at, you know, at one time during the 80s and early 90s, I mean, they had lots of people involved. I mean, they had like Christian camps, Bible reading centers, radio stations. I mean, they were a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, they believed in like an apocalyptic racial holy war. But these people got together with, people kind of like on the fringes of the NRA and like far right gun people. And they sat down, and out of those meetings, between neo-Nazis and other people on the right, that's what birthed the modern militia movement. And it wasn't until after the Oklahoma City bombing that some of the militia people, you know, actually, some of them actually put out a declaration stating, like, we're not white supremacists, you know, we disavow racism. But at one point, I mean, the militia movement was comprised pretty heavily of a lot of white nationalist, white supremacist groups. And you can also listen to our interview with Spencer Sunshine on the modern militia movement and kind of those dynamics. But it's interesting to point that out, that those incidents brought those people together, because they were, I mean, the far right was very successful in capitalizing on Waco and Ruby Ridge. And, you know, the person at the center of that, Randy Weaver, was actually, had gone to Aryan Nations events and considered himself a white nationalist. But I mean, they were able to capitalize on those events and make them about, guns and religion, and try to basically internalize that as white identity politics.
Yeah. And a couple shout outs. I mean, if people really want to understand the history of the far right, and I know we shouted this book out before, but, and it was just mentioned, but Leonard Zeskin, right? I mean, just like really read everything he's ever put together. It's exhaustive. It's long. There's a lot of literature there. But it's very detailed, and it gives you a lot of understanding of a lot of the paradoxes of the right wing, right? Like anti-government militia people starting to talk to white nationalists, for example, who believe in ethnic cleansing and like absolute government force, right? Seems to not make a lot of sense on its surface, but there's history behind that, right? You even see like militia groups in the US now who are avowedly anti-government organizations calling for detention camps for dissidents and leftists and things like that. And that sounds ridiculous and absurd on the surface, but there's history behind that. The other thing that I think a lot of people, if you really want to dig into this more, Netflix put out a really good documentary about Ruby Ridge. It's like 3 or 4 parts. And it really, I mean, they interview Randy Weaver's children that survived, which I think there's only one child that survived. They go into the dynamics behind that. They go into the fact that that whole thing started because the FBI was trying to infiltrate the Aryan Nation and, got Randy Weaver to sell a FBI agent a sawed-off shotgun and then tried to use illegal gun charges against him to get him to be an infiltrator. And so he refused to show up to court and decided to bunker down in his like hilltop cabin thing. And it led to like a very long standoff and federal agents were killed and all these things happened. Right.
But yeah, they ended up killing his wife. And
yeah.
One of his kids, I believe too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they killed his wife, his kid, his dog. And that was like, at least with his wife, with his son had shot at ATF agents and they shot back and killed him. His wife was killed by a sniper, without holding a weapon or anything. They just picked her off in the doorway of the house.
Yeah. I mean, by all accounts, it was bad. I mean, what they did was like horrible. I mean, they've obviously done very much worse to, other groups. I mean, the bombing against MOVE would be one example, but, yeah, they totally botched that. It was horrible. And also to like infiltrate a group like the Aryan Nations, I mean, you know, talk about just like a bad way to go about doing that. You know, what's interesting about the Ruby Ridge standoff is like out of that, that's when the white nationalist movement really started calling itself like white nationalists, or they use the term white separatists. And I noticed a lot of people, I've listened to podcasts or like other history people talk about it, and they've really picked up on that point. Well, he wasn't a white supremacist. He was a, you know, he was a white, he just wanted to live alone. It's like, well, I mean, that's true to some extent. He lived out in the middle of nowhere, but also it's like, you know, he was very much involved in the Aryan Nations, compound, which was, I mean, avowedly like swastikas everywhere, ZK alien, like, you know, they were neo-Nazis.
Security with guns. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and also like out of that circle, like came the Order, came a lot of like paramilitary, like, you know, literally white power terrorist groups. I mean, they were very much about overthrowing the United States government and like forcing people to adhere to their ideology. But I think that it's important to realize that like those people in that movement were smart enough to try to rebrand themselves. I mean, just like the alt-right would do later, or even now they're trying to, you know, get out of the term alt-right and become identitarians or something else. I mean, but still like within that instance, they realized that they really needed to really rebrand themselves because they had an opportunity to make common cause with a lot of just disaffected white people or even just gun owners.
But there's common threads here, right? So like one of the things they get into in this documentary about Ruby Ridge is Randy Weaver's wife was by all accounts the ideologue in the family, right? She was a preacher's daughter from an apocalyptic Protestant sect in Indiana. And what she was saying at the time, and there are letters that demonstrate this, is that she was convinced that they were going to shut down the highways and the UN was going to come down and blow up their house. But like, there was no evidence of that. And they weren't communicating with people on the outside. So where did that come from? Well, they came from a really common, right-wing conspiracy theory of the time, which still exists. I mean, you see this in, whenever there's a UN climate accord, the right wing freaks out and they go, look, the UN's trying to like decide whether or not I can buy grass seed or whatever. Right. And it sounds completely insane to people that aren't from the right wing, that don't have family members in the right wing, that live in areas where those things are really, sort of rare, like those political positions are really rare. But I think a lot of the time we think about conspiracy theories confined to Alex Jones. But in reality, Alex Jones is a product of that world too. And if we're going to really understand what these people are doing and really going to understand the threat that they pose, it is absolutely critical that we understand the history of the development of thought in the far right, because it is a whirlwind of different environments and different people and different groups and different ideologies, kind of merging together and breaking apart based on whether or not there's common cause. And those mergers and those separations really form a lot of the kind of discursive dynamics that would lead to someone like Donald Trump, right? He's coming in here. And I mean, his inauguration speech is a great example of this, right? He presented this idea of, you know, the United States and especially American cities as these smoking ruins of crime and violence and all these things. And like, yeah, if you live in a city, there's like violence and crime and stuff, but it's definitely not a smoking ruin. But what that's meant to do is it's meant to appeal to people from that world, which do think that way and think that way for often very racist reasons and are convinced that people are crossing the border to steal money and exploit social services and rape your children and all these other things, and that terrorists are sneaking over the border to like commit acts of terrorism. Or Tucker Carlson's thing recently is that, you know, look, all these, you know, refugees from Africa are now sneaking over the border, the southern border, and that's going to become the new refugee crisis in the United States, is refugees from Africa, right? And there were all kinds of like weird implications he drew about that, and all of those are grounded in a combination of racism and conspiracy theory. And he uses those lines, and he kind of plays in those tropes, because there's an audience for that that's much bigger than I think a lot of us really realize. Like the militia movement in the 90s had millions of members, right? And it's much smaller now. But in the 90s, it had millions of members, and those people did not go anywhere, right? They still live in places like Michigan and Oklahoma and Montana and places like that. You know, you've got organizations like in Montana in the late 90s, there's the Freemen, who literally took a whole town over. And there was a massive standoff with the federal government. And they were motivated by weird, like, sovereign citizen-based conspiracy theory stuff and racism, white separatism. But we can't understand things like the Bundys and the nature preserve takeover in Oregon and the politics that motivated that without really getting into the background of where these people came from, right, and what their categories of thinking are, because they're radically different than I think a lot of the rest of ours are. But there's not that few of them. There's many. Right. And that's something we need to be cognizant of.
Well, let's continue forward with talking about what's been going on in terms of immigration and also detention centers. Let's kick things off. What's been happening with this photo that's really going around?
Yeah. So there was a photo on CNN. And I think maybe some newspapers have published it this morning. It was a couple days ago, published it that morning. And what it showed was the bodies of a young father and his 2-year-old daughter, who had drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande. Since that photo came out, we've come to understand the story behind that, because reporters went to Matamoros, Mexico, which is where the family had been staying. They had tried to present themselves at a port of entry, at a border crossing, which is what they were, you know, legally supposed to do under the new kind of arbitrary asylum claim restrictions that had been imposed. They went for multiple days in a row. Border Patrol was just kind of taking their sweet time processing people. And so they were stuck in this camp, right? And they had been in Juarez for a while, and they had gone to Matamoros. And they were living an existence which is actually very typical of now tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people that have been trapped in northern Mexico under the stay in Mexico policy, which the Trump administration has sort of imposed through violence and force and essentially political terrorism. They're stuck in a place where they have no money. They don't know how long they're going to be there, so they can't go get jobs, if there are any to get. There's a lot of kind of anti-refugee rhetoric going on in towns in northern Mexico right now, and so a lot of people won't hire refugees. And there's a lot of violence and crime, and people get robbed and kidnapped and all kinds of things because, again, a lot of cities in northern Mexico are run by drug cartels. And so they're kind of stuck in this situation. And just like a lot of families, they decided to cross. And they had found a place in the Rio Grande, which was somewhat shallow. The father had crossed with his daughter first and left her on the U.S. side and was going back to grab his wife and noticed that his daughter had gotten back in the water to chase after him, because any of us that have small kids, that's what small kids do, you know? And so he went to go get her and got pulled in by an undertow. And they washed up on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande about 2 hours later. Someone was able to get a picture. And since the publishing of that picture, there's been a lot of very justifiable outrage about this. I think for the first time, a lot of people came to really understand what was happening and the cost that people were willing to risk to get here for their own safety, right? And, I mean, you have people like Shep Smith on Fox News, who is just the worst right-wing talking point echo box ever, breaking down in tears, trying to talk about this. And saying things like, you know, a lot of our families came here as refugees. You know, I know personally mine did. Most of the kids I grew up around, their families came here as refugees. And he was saying, like, none of the rest of us had to go through this. You know, there was hardship, but we didn't have to risk dying in the undertow of a river to get here. And he even started getting into, like, look, I mean, people don't leave their homes for no reason, right? All things that we've been saying here, you know, Highlights Magazine, which, again, anyone that's got kids, there's a pretty good chance your kids get that magazine. I know I got that when I was a kid. My child gets that magazine. Is entirely apolitical, you know, it's mostly like puzzles and stuff. They released a statement about this. There's a lot of people, I think, that are starting to understand for the first time what this really means. And unfortunately, in American discourse, images often play this role, right? We in the United States have a very, very, very long history of dehumanizing the other. Right. Our entire politics, our history is based completely on this idea. It's the only way that we could destroy millions of people and enslave millions more to build the United States, was through mass dehumanization, right? Just using any excuse necessary to forego any kind of complicated conversation about ethics, right? And the things that we're willing to tolerate and our ethical conscience.
You know, one thing I always like to point out is, like, if you look at all these Trump rallies, you know, the one thing that they're still chanting is lock her up in relation to Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton had a huge role in the coup in Honduras.
Yeah, she did.
Which led to the situation we're at now, where people are fleeing political repression and globalist economic policies. And these people are just treating these people that are trying to make a better life for their families, that are, like, you know, have the, you know, the fortitude to literally walk thousands of miles,
yeah,
to try to go somewhere else. And they're not even connecting the fact that this person that they supposedly hate so much, that they have built literally conspiracy theories around, like QAnon, which is, you know, based around, Hillary Clinton, Pizzagate, yeah. based around Hillary Clinton and other Democratic officials. This is something that these people, these politicians have done that they supposedly hate, but yet they're willing to look at these people just as scum. And the reason, of course, is clear. It's because of the color of their skin and where they come from and the language they speak. But it just shows that this ideology that these people have is just, it's not coherent. It's not based on anything real. It's chauvinistic. Mm-hmm. It's just based on, tropes and talking points and conspiracy theories and racism.
Yeah.
And that's all it is.
Well, and there's precedent for this kind of a shift in discourse, right? I mean, the moment that comes to mind immediately was, footage from the Tet Offensive in 1968. Where the Viet Cong simultaneously attacked hundreds of American, like, fire bases and forward operating bases in Vietnam on Tet, which is a kind of major Vietnamese holiday. And for the first time, because it was a surprise attack, there were reporters in those fire bases, and those reporters got footage. And for the first time, Americans saw, what the war in Vietnam meant. Most Americans saw that. And that is the thing that led to, for a lot of people, draft resistance, resistance to the war in Vietnam, the strikes on college campuses. All of that happened after Walter Cronkite was willing to show that footage on television for the first time. And I know for my parents, who were already against the Vietnam War by that point, that footage to them was this very motivating factor. Because for the first time, they saw the burned bodies of Vietnamese children. It wasn't just theory anymore. And so for people on the right wing, I think this is a real awakening for a lot of them. But even for a lot of people that aren't, I think there's a tendency to abstract the trials and tribulations and risks that migrants are taking, right? That refugees are taking. I mean, we should name it what it is, right? I mean, this is a refugee crisis born out of American foreign policy. And, but we intellectualize that, right? We think about numbers and we think about the politics of it and we think about, you know, how horrible the administration is and things like that. And we see pictures from the outside of children's detention facilities and read about the conditions inside those detention facilities, but it never really seems real. And I know, when I saw that image for the first time, and I know undocumented people, I know refugees, right? But when I saw that, it really hit me. Because, you know, in my case, I am a parent, and, I would totally do that for my kid, you know?
Well, yeah, who wouldn't? And again, I mean, how did the majority of people that live in the United States that are, you know, not indigenous get here?
Yeah.
Largely they got here, like you said, because they were refugees. I mean, Irish people. Why did a lot of Irish people migrate here? Well, because of potato famine that was caused by, you know, trade policies, in Britain that was trying to starve off Irish people. I mean, so many, so-called European people from different countries were pushed to coming here either, you know, from the carrot of land or that, you know, they were pushed out because of religious persecution or they were from rebellious political groups or just the fact that Europe was just a swimming cesspool of, you know, lots of poor people packed together, and disease. And then it made sense to push them out into the so-called new world, to work and to make money for, you know, colonial powers.
Yeah, and, political refugees, they came here fleeing fascism, poverty, like,
yeah,
that's how people got here, you know?
And again, like all of,
they're still trying to get away from.
Yeah. All of these Latin American countries largely that we're talking about where people are fleeing are countries the United States has spent decades and decades of overthrowing democratic regimes, you know, fighting against leftist and communist groups, you know, engaging in civil wars. I mean, look what they did with the Contras. They were literally selling drugs in the United States and African American communities to make money to fund, a very far right insurgency.
Yeah. Well, still, we're down there engaging in the so-called war on drugs, right? Like, there's massive U.S. government operations in a place like Guatemala or a place like Honduras, right? It's not just Colombia. But we have troops stationed all over Central America. And in a lot of places, what that's doing is it's amplifying the violence of street gangs, which for a lot of people is their only way to make money anymore. Because of the civil wars and because of the overthrow of democratically elected regimes, which is our fault. And this family was from Guatemala, specifically, right? If anyone's ever met anyone who came here from Guatemala in the 90s, or any former fighters from the FMLN, they can tell you what it was like when the Contras were operating in Guatemala and when the right-wing military regime was going from town to town just murdering people. It devastated the whole country, and people are still dealing with that. And this family was a family that was fleeing that.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if you're somebody that's on the right, you know, far right, you listen to Alex Jones, you literally believe that there's a globalist conspiracy, you know, against nationalism. I mean, then you're literally attacking the people that are like literally at the bottom, that are just like at the bottom, the victims of that.
Yeah.
I mean, how is U.S. imperialism, regime change, destroying, you know, the poorest people around the world and then forcing them to flee somewhere else? I mean, how is attacking them a blow against that system at all? It's not.
Well,
you're feeding into it.
What's even worse is that the reaction against this of people coming here as refugees, the reaction against this is entirely grounded in paranoid understandings and white fragility, right? This tendency of white Americans to even subconsciously just assume their entitlement to power. This whole fear of demographic shift, right? Like, it's the same thing that's been articulated for 150 years in the United States. And it's always only served the interests of the people that hold political power, right? And yet so many people in the United States have internalized this, that they are so afraid of losing their position to someone that might look different, right? And they're willing to watch 2-year-old children drown and die in numbers, to watch people get chased down by right-wing militias on the border, to watch people hit the point of starvation in northern Mexican cities or be confined to sleeping on concrete floors in child detention centers. Like, they're willing to be okay with that. And if that's where we've gotten to, we really need a very deep, very serious conversation about what the hell is wrong with us. Because the reality is that is absolutely unforgivable. Right? Kids shouldn't drown trying to cross rivers just so they can continue to live.
No, and again, I mean, these are, legally speaking, by the laws in place, you know, of this government, according to its own rules, they are allowed to do that. You are allowed to seek political asylum somewhere else. And there is supposedly a system in place which is supposed to allow these people to apply for that asylum if they have a legal, you know, they have a legal right to do so. And what's being put into place, which again is being influenced and directed in part by white nationalist think tanks like FAIR and people that are connected to that, people especially like Stephen Miller, is a policy in which, you know, they're trying to make everything possible as worse as it possibly can be to scare people away from coming out. So that means violence at the border. That means people dying in custody. That means, you know, facilities that are supposed to hold only 100 people holding 900. That means, I mean, literally, like, I was listening to the Young Turks the other day. I mean, think about these conditions. Like, you have children, like kids in diapers.
Yeah.
Sitting in these facilities that have not changed their diapers in 3 weeks. How is that even possible? Can you imagine the conditions of that? I mean, like, and again, like, as you said the last time around, like, if these conditions were happening in another country, they would be frontline news. But these are happening in the United States, you know, the richest country in the world, and they can't even find a way to change a baby's diaper.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and like, that is Ocasio-Cortez is dealing with a lot of backlash for calling these concentration camps. And the
their camps where concentrated populations are. I mean, they are concentration camps.
By definition. But what we're doing in these places is we're torturing children. Right?
Well, that's the other point of it, Nazism
just shy of the gas chambers, right? And the forced labor. I mean, we're watching it happen.
Well, I mean, they, again, like in Nazi Germany, they didn't start off as death camps. I mean, the first thing that they did is they rounded up political prisoners. They rounded up, Roma, queer people. I mean, that's how they started. And then they started to round up, you know, people that they had already moved into ghettos, into concentration camps. And then they began a system of mass extermination. I mean, it was a very slow, methodical process forward. And this was years after Hitler had been elected into power.
You know, and in Queens, people blockaded an ICE van this week, right? And I would say that at this point, that's a minimal response, right? Like, for anyone that has kids, you should be furious about this. And if you're not, you really need to examine where your head's at. Because I know I'm not an emotional person. I had to spend 2 or 3 hours just sitting with myself to deal with that. You know, and we saw similar images from people fleeing Syria too. These are the people bearing the brunt of right-wing populism right now, are the most vulnerable. Right. The people with nothing, the people that are living lives that in our worst nightmares, we hope we never have to. Right. That in our American comfort, we can't even imagine. And these are the people that are dying by the dozen. Right. Trying to just get anywhere. And I've said this before, but I know personally it would take a lot to force me to leave my house. To leave the place I grew up, to leave my friends, to leave my family. It would take me everything. It would have to be a situation where it was impossible to continue to survive if I didn't. And that is literally what these people are dealing with. And yet here they are drowning in rivers, right?
Yeah, I'm reading the book, Blessed in the Flame, or Blessed Be the Flame.
Yeah,
that looks at concentration camp resistance right now. There's one point in the book where they mention that this is about basically the ways that people resisted within concentration camps in a variety of ways within Nazi Germany. But there's one point they mention just the level of acquiescence that people had in society to the fact that this was going on. They mention one point there's a train rolling by, literally of naked women. You know, they've been stripped of their clothes and they're screaming at it like a bunch of workers at a work site. Like, we're literally being taken to the gas chambers. And the person writing this, this is happening said nobody even said anything, you know.
Yeah.
And that's so hard to imagine. And I think that all of us think like we would never allow it to get that bad. But the way that we allow it to get that bad is if we don't say anything now. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I'm hopeful for is at least in the last couple of weeks, when this kind of wave started, it's interesting because it's like a year after the Abolish ICE movement.
Yeah.
But this kind of wave that we're seeing right now, there's been like a wave of protests. There's been a variety of things that have happened from like sabotage stuff to like big protests to everything we're talking about with this photo. So there's been a lot happening in terms of that. This is basically caused because Trump came out and said, like, oh, we're going to round up all the migrants, and then walked back on that. But it's good to see that there's that pushback from people. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the good things that we can look to is that people are saying, where's the protest at? People are applauding the fact that people are flooding the phone lines and giving false information to ICE. People are applauding the fact that people are putting up graffiti saying like F ICE and mm-hmm. stuff like that. That's a good thing. And I think this is a time when, small acts like that, you know, small as they may be, And as easy as they may be to pull off, those are things that are going to have a very large reverberation at that at this time. So,
yeah,
you know, not that we would ever encourage you to do anything illegal, but I mean, this is a time that posters, stickers, and graffiti are going to go a long ways because they're going to resonate with people. And, you know, beyond that, I mean, now's the time to, you know, get together with people and protest, organize, you know, think about strategically where you can intervene. There's obviously a bunch of resources up, but it's going down. There's a long list that's being added to every day of different actions.
Only problem I have with what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says is it's not specific enough, right? She just called a concentration camp. She allowed it to fall into that sort of rhetorical back and forth, but we need to name it for what it is. I mean, what's happening right now is that the U.S. government is complicit in the death of dozens and dozens of people and the imprisonment of many more in a campaign that can only be considered in the lens of ethnic cleansing, right? And if we can learn anything from the failure of resistance in Nazi Germany or the success of resistance in Sarajevo in the 90s, it's that it takes normal people, regular people, not just radicals, but also your aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents and friends and regular people to do something about this. Because unfortunately, there's not enough of us to be able to flip this tide back. But there is enough of everybody else. And so the more people start to sit down behind ICE vans, and the more people that start to flood ICE's phone lines, and the more people that engage in economic boycotts and wildcat strikes against their employers for supplying detention centers, and the more people that are willing to shelter people and keep them away from getting sent home, like, these are the things that we should all be encouraging the people in our lives to do. Because this is a moment right now where we are at a precipice, right? We're staring into the abyss, and we're looking at a moment in which we can either decide to do something about this or go down in history as being complicit with ethnic cleansing. And that's the thing that we really need to think through. And I'm hoping that the narrative that's built up this week, because finally someone caught the reality of what's happening in an image, hopefully that starts to build some momentum about this, because regardless of what someone's politics are, there is no way that you can justify being okay with this. There's just literally not. It's inexcusable at this point. And if you are around people that are okay with this, I think you need to really rethink your friendships and relationships with people like that, because their priorities are horrendously skewed.
Yeah, I mean, not to put our nerd hats back on for a second, but I mean, it'll be interesting to see how much, if this continues to like really draw a line in the sand, even on, you know, outlets like Fox, like, is this going to really become more of a problem for Trump? Because I know in my own life, a lot of people that are, I would say political, but just people that kind of like, you know, on the borderline of like, yeah, maybe they voted for Trump or they like Trump somewhat because of some reason. I mean, the child separation thing really rubbed them the wrong way.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, like you were saying, for obvious reasons, I mean, they see kids getting hurt. I mean, how can you support that? And like, what is that doing?
Well, and for people that do, on the off chance, any people that do listen to this podcast, if you've got kids, look at your kids tonight, right? Look them in the eye and sit there and wonder if you'd be okay if that was your kid going through this, right? Think about what you would do if you had to leave home and we tried to run to Canada and all of a sudden they were like, nope, can't get in. And you decided to try and cross the St. Lawrence Seaway, right? Think about that, right? Look your kids in the eye and think about that, because I cannot imagine, unless you are an absolute monster, not feeling this very profoundly.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.